From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There are many unanswered questions about just how President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un will meet, when they meet by May, as we heard in that surprise announcement yesterday. Where will the meeting occur? Will there be additional conditions? Kim Jong-un says he will freeze his missile testing, and South Korean officials said their exercises with the U.S. military exercises will go forward. But will the two men apologize for their past language? Trump called Kim Jong-un little rocket man, and Kim called Trump a mentally deranged dotard.
And, of course, the announcement yesterday came on the same day that President Trump signed trade tariffs over the objections of allies and leaders of his own party. Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. Joining us today, Bloomberg White House correspondent Tolu Olorunipa and Fox News senior producer for Capitol Hill, Chad Pergram. Chad, let me start with you. The U.S. has tried for decades to rein in North Korea's nuclear program. No sitting U.S. president has ever met with the North Korean leader. What do you make of this? And is it risky for Trump?
It's certainly risky, but it kind of turns on its ear, you know, the traditional policy. This is something that this president is known for doing. You know, there's an old saw we hear a lot around Washington, D.C., that only Nixon could go to China. Well, maybe only Trump could go to North Korea. We don't actually know where this meeting will take place. But that is kind of the calling card of this administration, that they do things that are different. And here is someone, you know, President Trump, you know, threatening them with fire and fury, you know, some months ago. And now there's going to be a meeting. Just a couple of weeks ago, remember that Vice President Pence was criticized at the Olympics for not, you know, shaking hands with representatives of the North Korea delegation. That was not the de rigueur from other, you know, leaders and representatives from other countries there, but that was something that was singled out. And now you have President Trump. He's going to sit down with him. We'll see where this goes. It is inherently risky, mainly because, as you know, President Trump has a tendency to say that he's going to do things and then changes the position. We saw that with DACA. We've even seen that with firearms. And when you're dealing with potential foreign affairs and nuclear war, that's a bigger problem.
He could back out.
Well, it's risky, too, because Kim Jong-un could just say, look, I took the meeting and it didn't work and go on from there. Tolu, though, there are those, as we just heard, saying this could be Trump's, you know, magnificent Nixon in China moment. And South Korea seemed to indicate that it was his pressure and his language that got them to this point. Here's the South Korean National Security Advisor in that incredible announcement on the White House lawn last night.
I explained to President Trump that his leadership and his maximum pressure policy, together with international solidarity, brought us to this juncture.
So, Tolu, your thoughts. Is this his Nixon and China moment?
Well, the president definitely wanted to be seen in that light. He wants to be seen as sort of a straight deal maker who is doing what no other president could do before. And there is some risk in that, and that he may be eager to have a deal, eager to meet with the North Koreans and say that he's accomplished something. And it's not clear whether or not he's going to get anything in return. Right now, the North Koreans have put on the table some rhetorical objectives, including saying that they're willing to denuclearize, saying they're going to halt weapons tests. But it's not yet clear that that will actually lead to action. And that is going to be the clear test of whether or not this is a major significant foreign policy action by the president, or whether this is just sort of a PR move where both sides are trying to extract some sort of PR concessions from the other side, and we don't actually see action that can change the status quo, which is the U.S. and North Korea sort of on the path towards some sort of conflict militarily.
And don't forget how this kind of played out. It was the president just, you know, an hour or two after the meeting on tariffs, which was a major news story unto itself. He actually stuck his head into the briefing room and said that, you know, something was going to happen, you know, about the Korean Peninsula very soon. We've not seen the president show up in the briefing room in any capacity during his presidency. And the fact that he was already kind of trampling on this message about tariffs just an hour or two later and that this, you know, superseded it, you know, again, that's very reflective of how this administration operates.
Well, what about tariffs? That is a huge story as well. President Trump signing these steel and aluminum tariffs over the objections of some of his aides, Republican leaders and allies. On NPR's Morning Edition, the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross defended the policy, saying cost to produce a can of soda would only go up a half of 1%.
You really think 0.5% on a can of soda is going to destroy people's living? I don't.
Sounds like they might have tariffs on cell phone connections there. But Tolu, what about these tariffs? Is President Trump going to face significant opposition from Republicans, or are they going to stand back and let him do it?
I think it will depend on sort of how other countries respond to these tariffs, whether or not this escalates into a trade war, whether or not the president offers an off-ramp for various other allies, including South Korea, to get out from under these tariffs. If the president does that and shows that sort of great flexibility, which he said he was going to show with our allies, then maybe he won't face the pressure and the heat from a Republican Congress to sort of rein him in. But if there is this signal that things are going to escalate and that our allies in the EU and South Korea and other countries are going to retaliate and slap tariffs on goods from Wisconsin and Kentucky and other politically sensitive states, then you might see Congress sort of whip itself into action and figure out a way to try to rein in the president on these tariffs, because not only is he putting these tariffs on, he's already sort of looking at other actions that he can take, targeting China and other countries in the weeks down the road. So Congress may try to nip this in the bud if it looks like we're headed towards a broader trade war.
Well, Chad Pergram, what about if it also doesn't provide the jobs that is behind this, that the president has promised the steel workers and the other workers so left behind by globalism? It was interesting, Chad. I was watching this morning, as I always do, flipping back and forth between CNN and your network, Fox News. And on CNN, the headline was, you know, the little graph that you're looking at said Trump tariff promise upsets allies. On Fox News, it was Trump tariff promise thrills steelworkers. And they had one on who was talking about this. But we have been hearing over and over that even if there is more steelwork here because of these tariffs, it will be automated. It will not be, you know, people returning to their jobs. That's the other what if. What if it doesn't have that intended hope of bringing back the steel industry?
And this is why Republicans on Capitol Hill are freaking out. Ben Sasse, Republican senator from Nebraska, he told me yesterday that this was a, quote, stupid policy. And what you have here is this weird break among Republicans. You know, Republicans were willing to go along with President Trump. They were reluctant to get on his bandwagon generally when he was running for president. That started to change, as it was obvious he might have a shot to win. And certainly once he did win, they said, all right, maybe we can do something on health care. They got about halfway there on health care. They said, maybe we can do something on taxes. They certainly got that done. And now you have the first break. You have to remember that something that President Trump has never morphed in his policy positions. He's morphed on firearms and health care and a number of other things. He has never morphed on trade. That's something that he said long, long ago. And where you might have this adverse reaction from Republicans on Capitol Hill is as they look toward the election. They don't want to screw up the economy because they passed the tax bill. And what you might see here, we have to fund the government by the 23rd of March. Again, there has been some casual talk that they might try to attach something to that bill. We don't know. We don't think so. But there has been talk about that. But where you might see a separate piece of legislation to try to truncate these tariffs is if Republicans start to see that this is going to impact their election. And this is a problem in some of those states where you have a lot of seats in play. Pennsylvania, which, again, is a state that is impacted by steel. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of seats in Pennsylvania which could be in play. And they say, wait a minute, if this is going to affect us adversely, we need to do something here to protect ourselves on Capitol Hill.
Yeah. Well, something that they haven't done anything about is any kind of gun legislation after Parkland, Florida. This week at a Senate hearing, Fred Gutenberg, the parent of a student killed there, spoke passionately about NRA videos he's seen which call for a call to arms against gun rights opponents, saying their time is up. Let's listen.
I ask you a question. If this was put out by a terrorist organization, we would be raising the terror threat level in this country. Why are we letting this lobby have anything to do in D.C.? I don't understand it.
Tolu, Florida moved ahead this week on gun control legislation. Where is Congress?
Congress is still in debate mode, doing what it does best, sort of debating issues for a shorter period of time until the public moves on and then not doing anything. And we did see the president a couple of weeks ago say that he was going to do what no other president has been able to do and pass gun control legislation, but that is all sort of faded into the background as he's moved on to tariffs. And yesterday he had video game makers into the White House talking about maybe it's the video games that we need to focus on and not necessarily the guns. He met with the NRA, had dinner with them, and now it seems like they're singing from the same hymn book. And the president has sort of backed off, at least for now, on his calls to raise the age limit for guns and to have various gun control measures that could pass through the Congress. Right now, it seems like the House is not willing to go along with some of the things that senators want to do. So you have that sort of classic gridlock, which is making it difficult for anything to get done.
And you know, we see after each of these shootings that everybody says it's a seismic event. Well, it's not really seismic if Congress doesn't act here. You know, I was struck by a moment on Capitol Hill where Marco Rubio, the Republican senator from Florida, was introducing a bill to make it easier to impose restraining orders to take weapons away from people who may pose violence to themselves or others. And they said, well, why aren't you doing more? And he said, well, you do what you can. Well, the fact that they haven't done anything on this issue on Capitol Hill tells you a lot. They have done what they can. And what they did this week in the House of Representatives is they named 7 post offices. That's what they can agree on.
Yeah. That's Chad Pergram, Fox News senior producer for Capitol Hill. You're reminding us, though, both of you, what a week. What a week. We didn't even get to questions about the Russia investigation. We will pick it up on the other side. Chad, thank you. Tolu Olorunapa, Bloomberg White House correspondent. Thank you, Tolu, as well.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
And our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, is in California, where it's always easy to find a perfect avocado. And that's what she wants to talk about with us today. Kathy, they're a big menu item now everywhere, but especially where you are.
Yeah, in California, it's like the poster child for California cuisine. It seems that avocado is in everything from breakfast to lunch to dinner to dessert to smoothies. Everywhere.
Okay, well, full disclosure, I have at least 2 avocados every single week. And there is one thing that I want to say.
Can't believe you just admitted that.
How,
that's really deeply personal.
How to cut an avocado is something I feel like many people don't know. And I had a sushi chef in California show me how to do it the easiest way. You slice it vertically all the way around the pit.
Exactly.
And then turn it and do that again. So you have 4 quarters and you pull the skin off and that's that. And you get all of the fruit in the avocado.
I don't do it that way. I make a circle around the entire thing, cut it in half, and then I stab my knife into the pit and pull it right out, and then I scoop it
out. You scoop. Okay. Because I'm telling you, the other way, you can pull the skin off and get every little bit of the avocado.
I guess it depends what you're going to do with it. It's great that you're eating so many avocados because it is considered... No, I'm serious.
It's a good fat.
It's a superfood. It's full of fiber. It's got more potassium than a banana. But most importantly, it's a really good source of monounsaturated fatty acid, which is the good type that lowers your cholesterol.
Okay. Well, tell me what you've got in front of me right here in the studio. Starting, I guess, with what most people use their avocados for, guacamole.
I like a pure guacamole where you taste the avocado. So what you have there are some lightly mashed ripe avocados. Mm. There's a bit of red onion and fresh lime juice, little bit of jalapeno. You could add serrano with or without seeds and a touch of olive oil and salt and pepper. And that's it. I call it no nonsense guacamole.
So you don't put any cilantro in the guacamole?
Not in this one. So there are so many versions. You could add cilantro. You could add toasted pumpkin seeds. Many people like to add chopped ripe tomatoes to their guacamole or smoky chipotle peppers or a bit of cumin. But this guacamole is my homage to just the beauty and the pure, wonderful flavor of the avocado.
Okay, you've done something more unusual next to this guacamole. We've got deviled eggs with some kind of avocado something inside. What is this?
Yeah, so a big thing that you see, particularly in California, is avocado toast. And often you see it with a fried egg. And I thought, eggs and avocado are a great pairing.
Yes.
But what about a deviled egg with avocado as the filling? So I made the eggs the way you would for deviled eggs, and then I added a very ripe avocado so you get this gorgeous green color filling. And what's on top of it is furikake. Furikake is a Japanese spice mixture of black and white toasted sesame seeds, crumbled seaweed, a bit of salt and sugar. And I think the combination of this deviled egg with the creamy avocado and then the little bit of the punch with the furikake is a winner.
Mm-hmm. You can definitely feel that it's got a Japanese thing going on with this furikake.
Yeah, and if you can't find furikake, if you're not living near an Asian market or they don't have a good section in your grocery store, it's real simple to make, and we give you the recipe on the website.
Kathy, how do you pick a good avocado?
Well, it's a good question, because the truth is that they don't ripen on the tree. So the best way to tell is to very gently, let's repeat that, gently squeeze the fruit in the palm of your hand, and it should yield only slightly. If it's super soft and mushy, you don't want that avocado. I like to buy them when they're a little bit less ripe and then have a few throughout the week. Yeah. The other thing to know is if you buy an avocado and you're like, oh, I really want to make guacamole tonight, they're not ready, put them in a brown paper bag at room temperature and you add an apple. And what happens is that the fruit gives off a gas, which helps to ripen your avocados organically.
So many things you can do with an avocado. I was at a restaurant recently called Bar Mazana, where they serve a drink with that's like an avocado toast drink. It's called the Smoothie Moves.
What?
It is absolutely amazing. But what are the other things you like to make with avocados?
I love them with almost everything, particularly in a salad. This time of year, fresh citrus and avocado. I'll make a quesadilla with salsa and cilantro and cheese and avocado. One of the simplest ways is to just fill the cavity with some onion and salt or a little salsa because it's this natural container.
And some hot peppers, of course, I think.
Of course,
some chili flakes and olive oil on the top of an avocado is a perfect snack.
Exactly. I was really lucky. Recently, I was in Hawaii and went to Ono Farms in Kapawawi, Maui. How's that for a mouthful?
Very well said, yes.
And there I met Chuck Borner, who is an organic farmer and grows literally like 100 different types of fruit. And he took me on a tour of his avocado grove, and it was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. But what I learned from him were the five qualities that make a great avocado. Number one quality is that it's buttery. That's that mouthfeel of like a creaminess. Number two is the skin comes off easily. Number three is that the seed or the pit is small. Number four is that the skin outside does not stick to the seed. And number five is no grit inside the skin. And that's how an organic avocado farmer takes a look at really what makes up a great avocado.
And is it a fruit or a vegetable?
It is a fruit, for sure.
Kathy Gunst, Here and Now resident chef. We will have all of her recipes for avocados at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thank you.
Great to talk to you.
Well, let's go now to Washington, D.C., where snow is in the forecast this weekend. And if you've lived there, you know the city and the surrounding suburbs will come to a grinding halt, even with a dusting. Michaela Lefrak from member station WAMU tried to find some reason behind Washington's winter weather panic.
Shh. Can you hear that? It's the sound of snow not falling. That's happened a lot in Washington this winter. So far, the city's only had a total of 3 inches of snow. This is what the local news sounds like when the white stuff is forecasted.
Buy the loaves of bread now.
Right now, the calm before the storm.
We have a number of closings and early dismissals.
Mayor Muriel Bowser will deploy the D.C. snow team.
This could be historic.
Yep, the nation's capital panics about snow. We empty grocery stores of bread and milk, schools close, and the Beltway turns into a Hot Wheels pileup, all because of a dusting.
D.C.'s reaction to snow is unique.
Angela Fritz understands snow. She's a meteorologist with the Capital Weather Gang, and she's originally from Northeast Ohio, where they get upwards of 60 inches of snow a year.
By comparison, D.C.'s average of 14 inches per year is kind of laughable where I come from. And up in Cleveland, you know, 14 inches is a Tuesday.
She says the way we react to snow affects how she and her Weather Gang colleagues write about storms on their blog.
There will be times when we will see something in the forecast models and decide specifically that we aren't going to write about it because we don't want to start that panic just yet.
That's right. The meteorologists have to protect us from ourselves. But in our defense, Washington doesn't get as much snow as Chicago or Cleveland, so we don't have as much practice or as many snowplows. It kind of makes sense until you talk to people from cities that also get about 14 to 15 inches a year, like St. Louis. I called up Lewis Reed, the president of the St. Louis Board of Aldermen.
St. Louisans, I don't see them panic-stricken. You know, if indeed there's a forecast for inclement weather. At the end of it all, it will melt.
The prospect of snow is no laughing matter to Washingtonians. But there must be some legitimate reasons behind our panic, right?
There are a lot of challenges associated with this region, and even that small snowstorm can have a huge impact.
Dean Hunter has number one. As a director with the Office of Personnel Management, he's the guy who decides if the federal government will open late or shut down for a snow day. That decision can cost around $90 million a day, so Hunter doesn't make it lightly.
We have a 24-hour situation room or an operations center, which is continuously monitoring anything that might affect the status of the federal government. So it's a flurry of information.
That information's coming from authorities all across D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Plus, areas close to D.C., but a bit to the west, near the mountains, often get double the amount of snow as the city proper. And here's another reason, traffic. It's already hard to get around Washington roadways on a clear day. Angela Fritz of the Capital Weather Gang says, add in some snow and newcomers who aren't used to driving in it, and things get crazy.
Having all of these people out there on the roads, D.C. winters can be pretty rough for people. Even I have been stuck in this, so I always tell people, you know, don't feel bad. You know, it happens to the best of us.
Finally, since she's cutting us some slack, we should probably cut some for her and her fellow forecasters, too. D.C.'s temperature often hovers right around 32 degrees in winter. That makes it hard to predict if there will be rain, snow, or ice.
Sometimes forecasting here can be a little tricky, and there have been a couple of instances that can leave you feeling a little bit unsure about things.
So Washingtonians do have some good reasons, or excuses, for why a little snow can feel like a blizzard, at least in our minds. For Here and Now, I'm Michaela Lafrac in Washington.
And people, the snow could come late Sunday there in D.C. by bread.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Last night, a former police officer in Asheville, North Carolina, was charged with felony assault after video surfaced showing him beating and using a stun gun on a man. Officer Chris Hickman, who is white, was out late at night with a trainee when they came across Johnny Jermaine Rush, who is black. Rush had just finished a 13-hour shift at Cracker Barrel and was cutting across an empty parking lot. The trainee accused him of jaywalking and trespassing. When Rush expressed exasperation, the streets were empty. The trainee said he had to cuff him. Rush ran, and Officer Hickman can be seen on the video tackling, beating, and choking him. Matt Bush is news director for Blue Ridge Public Radio. Matt, this happened in August. Hickman resigned in January. Police body cam footage in North Carolina is not public record, so people didn't see this until it was leaked to the Citizen Times last week. That's one delay. But why else are police saying this took so long to be made public?
There were also other things with the investigation into Mr. Hickman that took up to 4 months until the criminal investigation started. It was that length of time that is really what has the community here very upset.
Sure. Well, and you were at a community meeting this week. We've heard some people saying things like, this isn't the 60s. You know, what are people saying?
There's a lot of frustration with this, and it touches on a lot of the underlying issues that are already here in Asheville. This is a very segregated city, and it's become more so as the city has become more popular as a vacation destination. And some of the historic neighborhoods, including the South Slope neighborhood where this incident happened back in August, were once predominantly African-American neighborhoods, but they have seen a lot of change and gentrification as the city has sort of transitioned into this very popular vacation destination.
Well, is this also underscoring what we've been seeing in other incidents? This idea of somebody stopped and harassed for jaywalking and cutting across an empty parking lot.
Right, and this happened very late at night. There was not any, very little traffic at all in this area. The police chief has been here for a little more than 3 years. She was brought in to do a lot of reforms within the Asheville Police Department. And now she's under fire for this incident, and a lot of city leaders certainly felt that her reforms were beginning to take hold. A lot of people feel this incident has really returned things to square one.
Well, and just to underline what you just said, this corner, apparently where this happened downtown, is where hundreds of people pour out of baseball games, for instance, and jaywalk across the street. Don't wait for the light.
I've jaywalked on that area going to an Asheville tourist game, which is the baseball stadium there, the baseball team. And, you know, any given night when the baseball team is home, there are hundreds of people who are jaywalking across that area.
By the way, are there people standing up for Hickman, who's now been charged with felony assault and communicating a threat? Because as Rush ran, Hickman yelled, "You're going to get effed up hardcore." We can't say what he actually said. Are there people defending him?
Not that we have seen. In fact, the head of the local Fraternal Order of Police Lodge spoke at that meeting very briefly this week, the public meeting, and saying, kind of put a lot of the blame squarely on that officer for the incident. There was no real defense even from the Fraternal Order of Police. And as part of the documents that have come out this week about his personnel record, the police went back and reviewed 58 hours of footage from his body camera and found 4 other instances separate from this that showed him, as they put it, showing discourteous or rude behavior toward members of the public.
Matt Bush, news director for Blue Ridge Public Radio. Matt, thank you.
Thank you, Rama.
Following the school shooting that killed 17 people in Parkland, Florida last month, many turned their focus to mental health. But here's a problem with our mental health care system right now. There's a shortage of psychiatrists. Joining us now is Dr. Daryl Kirch, who's president and CEO of the Association of American Medical Colleges. He's also a psychiatrist and a neuroscientist. Dr. Kirch, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeremy.
And what are some of the big causes of this psychiatrist shortage in America? Are there fewer people going into the field? Is the demand growing? Is it a combination?
Actually, there have been, in recent years, more people going into the field. And in recent years, every available training position in psychiatry has been filled. The thing that's really driving the shortage is the baby boom. Every day we have 10,000 baby boomers turning 65, and they have the highest health care needs, and that includes mental disorders.
So what do you do about that? If it's not that you can't get enough people to go into the field, what you need is even more people to go into the field.
That's correct. And actually, there are 2 steps to this. One is to expand medical schools so that we have more candidates in the first place. And U.S. medical schools have done that. They've actually increased the number of places 30% since the year 2000. So medical schools have done their job, but we have an interesting situation in the United States now. The number of residency training positions, these are funded by the federal government, that number has been capped for 20 years now by legislation. And now that the population is both growing and aging, it's become the bottleneck. We need to create more training positions in psychiatry and other specialties, and the funding for that expansion of residency training isn't been forthcoming.
And is it an expensive endeavor to do that?
Not compared to other items in the federal budget. It actually would be a minor expenditure, considering the fact that it's really the health of the nation that's at stake.
Well, what kind of strains are put on the system, on the nation, because of this shortage of psychiatrists?
Well, the people who are affected first are those who are typically underserved, people who live in more remote rural areas, people in some less advantaged urban areas, people who lack health insurance. So those are the populations hit hardest and first. But in terms of mental health care and availability of psychiatrists, we're seeing it across the board, all areas of the country, all groups.
Now, there's a federal law that calls for mental health to be covered in the same way other chronic conditions are covered. But do people choose not to go into psychiatry because the insurance coverage isn't as adequate?
Insurance exists. You're right. There's a federal law that declared that there should be parity between medical and mental disorders. The problem is that any psychiatric treatment is typically under-reimbursed. The reimbursement is at a very low level compared to things like surgical procedures. And that low reimbursement level has created multiple problems. It makes it harder for systems to recruit and adequately pay psychiatrists. It's led to a massive closure of mental health beds across the United States. So while our mental health needs, anxiety, depression, and then the very severe disorders like schizophrenia and often bipolar disorder, the problems that require hospitalization, things like acute suicidal ideation, we have those patients sitting in emergency rooms because there simply isn't a hospital bed available for them.
Hmm. And acute suicidal ideation is what?
Somebody who is at high risk to commit suicide. And often, typically, it's somebody who's depressed, but sometimes it can come about for other reasons and in relation to problems like substance abuse. But the fact is, it's a real danger. It's a potentially lethal disease.
Psychiatric treatment also requires a lot of time. There's often a lot of trial and error when it comes to prescribing psychiatric drugs. Is that part of this issue?
It definitely is. When I teach medical students about psychiatry, I point out to them that, unfortunately, science hasn't gotten to the point where we have brain imaging or blood test to identify whether somebody has an anxiety disorder or a mood disorder like depression or bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. The psychiatrist needs time to make the diagnosis by listening to the patient's story, their symptoms, and their history. That doesn't lend itself to a 5 or 10 minute office visit. It requires both time and longitudinal follow-up. And that requires people, person power, and we just don't have enough psychiatrists to fill that need.
Do you think that physicians can pick up some of the slack here, that you could just go to your doctor and get these things prescribed rather than going to somebody who's a specialist in psychiatry?
The fact is, that model is probably one of the keys to dealing with this crisis. There now are a number of centers across the United States who are developing what's called a collaborative care model. You would have a primary care clinic and a psychiatrist working with that group of primary care physicians, advising them about what medications to use. And then when they face a very complex or severe psychiatric case, the psychiatrist can step in and manage the patient. Another technique that can help address the problem is the use of telepsychiatry. There are programs now very active in states like Colorado and New Mexico where a psychiatrist sitting at an academic medical center at a teaching hospital in a major city can do outreach to primary care physicians in the most remote areas of the state.
There may be some people who are listening to us talk about this, and they will say, the problem is we're over-medicating people in this country. You say we've got a big baby boomer population that all need psychiatric treatment, but maybe some of them don't, And that's the issue.
There's certainly, in every area of medicine, maybe patients who are prescribed a medication that isn't really indicated. I'm not sure that that's any more prevalent in psychiatry than any other specialty. When you look at the fact that one out of five adults in the United States experiences a mental disorder during any given year. The most common is anxiety. The second most common, depression. 60% of those adults who experience that mental disorder do not get treatment for it. So there's this huge reservoir of untreated mental illness in the country.
Is the stigma that still exists today when it comes to mental health playing a role here in getting people maybe not to go into the field?
I do believe it may play a role. It certainly plays a role for patients. You know, just think about the fact that if one experiences a cancer or has a surgery, you get flowers, you post on your Facebook page about your progress. People with mental disorders tend to struggle in silence, and that because of that stigma. And that's so unfortunate.
If there's somebody in Congress or at the White House who is listening to this, what would your message be to them? What can they do?
The thing that is most directly in their control is pass the legislation that is sitting right now in the House and in the Senate that would expand residency training positions. It isn't just psychiatry. It's primary care, orthopedics, cardiology. There are people who are struggling to get the care they need in this country. And you can't just pull doctors, new doctors, off the shelf. It takes time to train them. And that means we need to free up the residency training position, expand it to meet this growing, aging population. Congress needs to take action now. This is approaching a crisis.
That's Dr. Daryl Kirch, who is president and CEO of the Association of American Medical Colleges. Dr. Kirch, thank you for joining us.
Jeremy, thank you so much. It's an important topic, and I appreciate your time.
Porn star's allegations about Donald Trump have made headlines, but if there wasn't so much other news, would we be hearing more about it? NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has been giving this some thoughts. Hi, David.
Hey, Robin.
And to recap, Stormy Daniels says Trump's lawyer paid her in the final days of the campaign to keep quiet about a past affair with Donald Trump. This week, she filed suit against Trump, saying that he didn't sign the accompanying non-disclosure agreement, so she has the right to talk about it. Then White House spokesperson Sarah Sanders said, well, actually, Trump lawyers went into arbitration this week to stop her, and they won. But then they may be lost because that's the first admission from the White House that there actually was a non-disclosure agreement. But your thoughts overall on how big a deal this is and how much coverage it's received?
I think this is a really big deal. Yeah. I think this was a case that would be a story that would be blotting out the landscape, that would be dominating headlines and front pages were this any other president in any other presidency for day after day after day. It would be almost immobilizing. Think about the facts that you've just described so concretely and factually. You've got a woman who's a pornographic actor who has alleged a consensual sexual liaison with the president of the United States for which she was paid six figures secretly by his lawyer. That's a big deal. This was done right before the election as to cloak and shield this information from coming to the public. Now, people have made allegations about relationships with the president before he took office, before his candidacy. This is in some ways baked into our understanding of who he is. But, you know, this was a payment made, essentially, you know, an extraction of money. You could look at this as a form of extortion, or you could look at this as a form of hush money, or both in a non-legal sense. But it has to reflect how we think about this president and this figure in the White House and other issues about whether or not there's other compromising materials on him. I've got to say, you know, her you listen to somebody like Jacob Weisberg, the head of Slate, who interviewed her in 2016 about this but only felt able to report on it as she's become more public on these matters. And he talks about her tale being remarkably consistent throughout.
Right.
And you look at the statements of the president's lawyer, less so.
Okay. Well, look, you say this would have taken down other presidents. As we know, the press didn't even cover past affairs. We're thinking of JFK. The thinking in the past, it was off the table. But if they had back then, it would have been devastating for Kennedy because the voters expected more from him. With Trump, you just alluded to this, his voters don't have that same expectation. They voted for him, hearing him say things on tape, you know, what he would grab, that would have brought down any other president. Does that have something to do with this? They're also pointing, I've heard evangelicals point to, you know, Bill Clinton and say, well, at least what Trump is alleged to have done with this woman, it's between two consenting adults. It wasn't abuse of power like Bill Clinton's affair with an intern in the Oval Office. You know, is that a part of this, that it doesn't get traction because the people, you know, who are backing the president strongly still just know all about it and don't think it matters?
Well, in some ways, you could argue to news executives have baked a certain streak of cynicism about Trump's personal behavior into their coverage, although I think you've seen it become more muscular in recent days, maybe the past week or so. I think you could look at conservative evangelical leaders who have seemed to have decided, by and large, coverage suggests, for political reasons to support this administration because some of the policies that he's backing are ones that they want and not really looking at the man, kind of an inverse of what they advocated that liberals do during the Clinton administration. I covered the Clinton impeachment crisis. And I do think that the Paula Jones case, which followed him into the White House but stemmed from his days as governor of Arkansas, and also, of course, Monica Lewinsky, to which you alluded, mm-hmm. were questions of abuse of power but also real scandals that attracted significant attention. This thing isn't about something that is non-consensual. And I don't know if it brings him down. I don't know if what brings people down or not. What I do know is that these things are worthy of coverage. And what I do know is that a payoff of that matter in the days before the election suggests a relationship between his concerns about what's being alleged and keeping that from the public. It's not that he's baking that into the equation and saying, I'm not worried if you find that out.
Well, look, we've reported before on how some of the president's friends in right-leaning outlets, like the National Enquirer, have helped him cover up allegations that they helped him cover up some of these stories. But you mentioned the vulnerability. There was that Steele dossier, which is controversial. Some of the reporting is unverified. But the leak alleged that the president was vulnerable to foreign influence because of his behavior.
I think that it is, you know, some of the things in the Steele dossier appear to have borne out over time, and I think it's hard not to look at the Stormy Daniels, her real name Stephanie Clifford, mm-hmm. you know, her allegations seemingly effectively substantiated at minimum by the fact that you heard the White House press secretary saying, well, they took her to arbitration to compel her to be quiet about this, acknowledging that there is some heft to the contract that she said was signed between her and the president's lawyer. Look, it's very hard not to look at that basket of information and be concerned that the person in the Oval Office not have acts or behavior in his past that could compromise him or in some ways be pressure points if somebody who's a pornographic actress is able to extract a six-figure sum from him.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you for your thoughts as always.
You bet.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.